Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday morning. It is the 23rd of August. Very nice to have you with us. Very nice to be back. And thanks to Ray for filling in, doing a wonderful job as always. I thought you would agree with that, Alan.
Oh, no, yeah, yeah, he was great.
All right, great. I was away.
And he has great bumper music, too.
Oh, good. You know? Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
So, good morning. Welcome to the program. Well, we have some exciting news. I'll get to that in just a second. We have a new member joining us, but let me introduce the rest of the panel first. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I don't know if you're aware, but that on September 3rd, which is a Saturday, I've been very nervous because I'm bringing the Berkshire Ramblers into Arlo's Church as a big fundraiser for
the Guthrie Center.
Guthrie Center, yeah. 413-528-1955. And you can remember 1955. It's a good year. At least I can remember 1955. And
Gunsmoke was on TV.
Yeah, it certainly was that. It certainly was that. And so it's going to be great. The only reason I'm nervous, Joe, I just want you to know, is not in this incredibly self-serving pronouncement, is that I'm worried not about selling tickets. I'm really worried that the same thing that happened last time is going to happen again. There aren't going to be enough to go around. People are going to be mad at me. And this one thing I can't afford in this job is for people to be mad at me.
I know.
See what I mean?
I know. It keeps you up at night.
It does. Yeah.
So, well, we'll certainly remind people again, but it's Wednesday.
8 o'clock. No, it's Saturday.
Saturday, night. September 2nd.
3rd.
3rd.
Yeah.
Third. Yeah, whenever.
Third.
Saturday,
yeah.
September 3rd.
Now, do you remember the telephone number?
413-528-1955? Okay, all right. Yeah. And that's for...
get there early on the 2nd.
Alan and the...
It's that important.
And the Berkshire Ramblers. All right. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Thank you very much, Mike.
Good morning.
And we have a newbie in the house. This is exciting. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a PR and strategic communications consultant, has worked in policy and politics at the national, state, and local levels for many, many years. And just tell us a little bit, for the folks at home, tell a little bit about a sketch of your resume, because it's quite impressive. You worked for Senator
There's
Kennedy.
Not enough time to do your whole resume.
Yes, I worked with Senator Kennedy. I worked in the Congress in the House of Representatives in the 80s for the House Judiciary Committee and for a congressman from Michigan. And then in the 90s, I worked for Senator Kennedy as he was chairman of the Labor and Human Resources Committee. That's where we did health policy, higher education, K-12 education, raise the minimum wage, those kinds of issues. And I worked for the Democratic National Committee as deputy director of the Platform Committee in 1988 and a whole host of other jobs along the way. Lots of campaigns in between all of that.
We were looking for someone more qualified.
I'm delighted to be here.
With a little political insight.
Yes, yeah. We wanted somebody who really could tell us how the sausage was made.
I've watched the sausage be made. It's fascinating.
Well, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us. It's a delight to have you here. Let's start off with, let me remind you, of course, that you can join us. And we love your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us begin with Donald Trump on immigration, the story that keeps on giving. I don't know how much was discussed in this yesterday, but over the weekend there were murmurings that there was going to be a change afoot in the direction that the Trump campaign would go when it comes to immigration policy, and there were some signs that perhaps what he had been saying all along since the very early stages of the campaign.
Since day one, actually.
Yeah, since the day he came down the escalator.
And talked about Mexican immigrants being rapists and murderers. Yeah.
So that there would be a point that many who had been advising him officially and unofficially saying, well, you know, maybe that is not like the best thing and probably won't win you the White House. So then there seemed to be a bit of a change. And then, of course, the question came out, well, is this a flip-flop? Is this a flip-flop? Is this a flip-flop? And then yesterday, there was supposed to be, in the morning we heard, there was going to be a big national speech on Thursday detailing the plans. That's now been canceled. And as of last night, at his, in his speech in a rally given at 9 o'clock last night, he kept on saying, we're going to build the wall. Don't worry. We're still building the wall. Mexico's paying for it, and we're going to keep them out, and we're going to build the wall. So there is some frustration on many people's parts simply because they don't know exactly what the Trump policy is. And I'm just going to say this truthfully, not as a commentary, but it doesn't really seem as though the Trump campaign knows what the Trump policy is on immigration at this particular point.
Well, Joe, they brought their two top new people in, Bannon and what's the lady's name?
Conway.
Yes.
Conway. Kellyanne Conway.
And she seems to be, I want to get this guy elected, and is saying things like, let's walk some of this stuff back. He, on the other hand, has a reputation, you know, Breitbart and everything, of being an ultra-conservative type. And apparently, they're duking it out. And in the middle are the kids, who are the, you know, sort of top advisors. So what you project yourself into the room when all of this in the last one, apparently the last one in to see that Donald is the one who prevails. Have you ever had a boss like that? The last one in, you know, to everybody, and then the last one in sort of becomes the person.
Well, it appears that she's clearly pivoted, but I don't know that he's pivoting with her. And I think her comments Sunday were essentially a trial balloon to see how people would react. And I think she understands that down ballot they need cover on this issue. And last night, Trump made it clear he's not necessarily going to give people cover or himself cover on these issues. I think she's trying to soften up not necessarily the Latino vote. I think they've lost that, but trying to get the suburban women and try to soften him up to attract more of the suburban women vote. But it's not clear that he's going along, or maybe they're trying to, you know, touch base with all sides and see if they can fuzzy up the issue enough so people won't remember. But people are going to remember what he said for the last year and a half.
Given the rapidity of the campaign, meaning that there isn't a lot of time between lip and cup, it does seem that even of a speech that was scheduled for Thursday, that they would be able to get their act together for that, to then say, let's pause, let's wait, and we'll try it again in a couple of weeks.
Well, I think the trial balloon, you know, that Kellyanne Conway floated over the weekend, and Trump's meeting with Hispanic leaders over the weekend, was the test that they needed to sort of weigh things. And it was clear even yesterday that his most staunch supporters, the ones who would support building a wall and marching the 11 million immigrants out of the country at gunpoint, were pushing back already on his softening position. So last night, I think he made it clear, I'm with you guys, and he's not ready to soften this position after having floated that trial balloon.
Well, you know, I love the fact that Teresa's with us, and I'm going to tell you why, because she's a seasoned person in this area. But it seems to me those of us who have been teaching political science for 1,000 years and everything else always know what the rule is. You got to go hard right if you're a Republican in the primary, leftist in the Democratic primary. But then you run like hell to the middle in order to win. Connelly clearly knows that.
Exactly.
And is doing what she does. I disagree with some of what I've heard here this morning, which is that there's not a lot of time left. I think months
is
an immense amount of time. Right. Although I must say the New York Times this morning, their betting number is now, he's down to 12% in winning.
Oh, it's been there before. It wasn't it 87? I guess 87.
Yeah, so it's 88 to 12 right now. But if you look at the key number, which is the polls showing what the differences are, we're talking about 6 or 7%. That's what we're talking.
I agree. I think the campaign really begins after Labor Day.
Absolutely.
They always do. They always begin again after Labor Day. And I think you're seeing Kellyanne Conway. She understands how to win. She's trying to pull him into a position. But I also think the problem with this immigration issue for Trump is a problem with a lot of issues for Trump is not only the politics, but he doesn't understand the nuances of the policy of it, too. And so I think he gets tripped up in the details on the actual substance of it. And even with Kellyanne Conway, when she was pressed the other day about, well, specifically, what are you going to do? She hesitated because it's the, you know, in the specifics of immigration policy is, you know, or the devil is in the details, of course.
Sure. And she said to be determined.
To be determined. She really held back on that because that's where you lose a lot of people. You know, you can build a coalition if you talk about it in a broad way, but once you get into the specifics, it gets a lot harder.
When it comes to those specifics, though, and I mean, to Alan's point, we do have a long time here, but we also have a long time to go back and forth. I understand your point of running to the center, to the middle, but he hasn't seemed to be overly wanting to do that or really to do anything politically conventional.
You know, there's a wonderful political scientist, not to get that way with you,
don't get that way with me.
Named James Barber, who wrote on presidential power. And, you know, he said a lot of people set their clock by their first political success. So here is this guy who had his great political success in the primary season by turning on a relatively small group of people with all this stuff about walls and, you know, immigrants and Muslims and all the rest. And he is loath to leave it because he doesn't believe it. He thinks, well, it worked. And why isn't it going to work again?
Right. I think that's exactly what he needs to do. He needs to broaden it and soften it if he's going to. And Teresa, to your point, he's not appealing to Hispanics because no. I think he's lost those votes too. It's just his appeal last week to blacks, saying African Americans, saying, "What have you got to lose? You know, go with me. What have you got to lose?" That wasn't to them really. It was to white middle class people in the suburbs hearing him reach out to African Americans and hearing him reach out to Hispanics and saying, "See, he's compromising. He's softer than he sounds." It's to make him more sellable to a broader base within the Republican Party, don't you think?
Right. Yeah. He gave a speech in the suburbs. He was targeting people in the suburbs.
There is the Los Angeles Times poll out showing Donald Trump ahead by 1 percentage point. And a very close race with Donald Trump at 44.6% and Hillary Clinton with 43.5% as of August 22nd, which was yesterday. So by all accounts, still, now this is one poll and seems not to be in line with many of the other polls that show her with 7 or 8 points ahead. But still, it is one poll that that shows this race very, very close.
And that newspaper is not exactly a Republican bastion.
No.
So, you know, you don't think they're up to mischief. Unless, of course, you know, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, unless they're looking to motivate people, you know, to remember that this election is by no means over. But I think it's probably an honest poll. And I do think there are a lot of Americans who Trump is turning on with his thing of, you know, that Muslim guy in your neighborhood, he could be a killer. You know, it's disgusting, but it is what he is doing and what he has done effectively.
Fear is a very effective tool.
Absolutely.
In an election. Yeah.
Nice.
We saw it in 2004 when Bush W. ran for re-election. He scared people into voting for him.
So Teresa, one of the questions I have for you as a sort of Kennedy watcher, as he exited the scene, and so many of us were so bereft, you know, about it, was that I'll never forget when he came out on that stage and endorsed Barack Obama in 08. Was that 08, right?
And correct.
Carolyn Schlossberg did the same thing. There were tears in a lot of people's, you know, eyes that the great liberal lion, you know, had done this. So what was it that you think, you know, made it happen, number one, but also how, you know, what is it about Hillary Clinton that keeps making people dislike her?
So I wasn't working with him at that time, but I think that he understood at that time the change that could potentially happen with Barack Obama. And he understood that he had tremendous leadership qualities and that it was Barack Obama's time. So I think, and he said at the time, it wasn't so much that he opposed Hillary Clinton. He had worked with her for years. I mean, we did a lot of events with her on health care. She helped lead on the children's health issue and a whole lot of things. He was very close to the Clintons. But I think he made a determination that this was a historical opportunity for historic change, and that it Barack Obama's leadership was a leadership that was needed at that time.
Interesting.
And I think that, and I've talked to a number of people around him at that time. I got a call from my former boss, and we talked about it a little bit in advance after the decision had been made, but before the speech had been made. But it really was created a significant shift in the conversation at that time and brought a lot of people over. And I really think his voice is missing this year as well. And I think he would be at this time. You never know for sure, but I believe that he would be strongly behind Secretary Clinton at this time because she supports so many of the things that he dedicated to his life to, health care, child care, immigration issues, minimum wage, those kinds of things.
So what would you do if you were her right now?
What would I do if I were
What would you advise her to do, at least, right now, to counter this sort of negative image that Trump has been successful in?
Well, not only Trump, but the emails and, the emails and everything else. What should she do?
We have about a minute, and then we'll come back and talk more about some of the stuff.
Right. I think that this is a very different year. I'm not trying to duck the question, but Trump is a very different candidate. It's a very different atmosphere. But I think that she has to keep doing what she's doing. I think the email issue has been litigated. I would go hard on him on his taxes. And I think this issue with Trump about the debt and who holds his debt and his conflicts of interest, his potential conflicts of interest, are very serious. You saw a big story in the New York Times this weekend on Sunday Times on this issue. Yeah. I think there's a lot more there that needs to be addressed.
Isn't she also vulnerable on that very topic, though, with the Clinton Foundation?
Not in the same way of the conflict, of personal conflicts of interest. We've never had a presidential candidate like Donald Trump who has this much wealth, this much global connections, and this much debt that foreign countries, that banks, foreign banks are holding. And how they work those conflicts of interest is fascinating, is yet to be discussed.
I was surprised, we have to go in about 8 seconds here, but I was surprised that yesterday on Bill O'Reilly, Trump, in response to the Times piece, said, well, $650, that's not a lot of debt. Okay.
not if you believe that he has $10 billion,
right,
which a lot of
it.
Us don't.
Yes. We're going to take a break. We'll be back and continue our conversation in just a few moments. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome you. Roundtable@wamc.org. If you would like to join us, we have Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, all. Very nice to have you all here. All right. Let's go back. We were talking about Hillary Clinton and emails. The story this morning, of course, a dispute over Hillary Clinton's email practices now threatens to shadow her for the rest of the presidential campaign after the disclosure on Monday that the FBI collected nearly 15,000 new emails in its investigation of her and a federal judge's order that the State Department accelerate the document's release. As a result, thousands of emails that Mrs. Clinton did not voluntarily turn over to the State Department last year could be released just weeks before the before the election in November. The order by Judge James Bosberg of Federal District Court came the same day a conservative watchdog group separately released hundreds of emails from one of Mrs. Clinton's closest aides, Huma Abedin, who put a new focus on the sometimes awkward ties between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department.
Teresa, I guess I wanted to go back and ask you about the Clinton Foundation. I know you have some pretty strong views on that.
Right. Well, I think that the Clinton Foundation does tremendous work. They get an A rating from Charity Watch, and they have done work all over the world very effectively. And I think that the Republicans have been very effective in what I call swift voting the Clinton Foundation. And for those who remember when John Kerry was running against Bush, John Kerry was the war hero and Bush was the draft dodger. But by Election Day, we would have thought that John Kerry was the draft dodger and George Bush was the war hero. And I think that the same thing is happening with the good works of the Clinton Foundation. Not that questions shouldn't be raised and asked and answered. But the question of the emails has been litigated. It's been litigated extensively. And I think that the good works of the Clinton Foundation have been lost in all of this. And while obviously there will need to be separation if she wins from her husband and her family from the foundation. But again, I go back to Donald Trump's record. And I wonder why there's not, because this is all a question of, are there conflicts of interest? And I think that there are serious questions about conflict of interest with Donald Trump around his business dealings around the globe, around his debt issues, debt that's held around the globe, that really need to be examined as closely as the issues of the Clinton Foundation are being examined.
Yeah, but two wrongs don't make a right. So in other words, if we say that just for the sake of the argument, if we say that Hillary has some problems here, and you keep coming back to the bad things that Donald Trump has done, I agree with that. But on the other hand, Hillary is going to have to answer for some of the stuff. One of the things I'm fascinated by with the emails is we keep hearing about the emails, and we keep hearing about how some of them, are out there, but we don't hear much about what's in those emails. You know what I'm saying? Does that surprise you?
Well, for me, the email question is also interesting in that a lot of the emails have been made public.
Yeah.
And this new batch, which they may or may not be new, I read about, we don't know yet what's in them. But I think, just take the word of the FBI director when Comey said that there's no evidence that the emails were purposefully deleted or that there was any intent to conceal them. I mean,
right.
He's been clear on that. So what are these emails? They may be new. They may be those that were deleted, as they said, in the normal course of business, not for the purposes of hiding. We don't know what's in this new batch yet.
But how about the old batch?
Well, the old batch have been many of them have been made public.
Yes, but why are we not hearing a smoking gun?
Because there are no.
Yeah.
They haven't found any smoking guns.
Right.
And even in that came out this over the last few days, if you look at the examples of those that they gave, there was an interaction between her top aide and Brand from the Clinton Foundation, asking if they would do a favor, an immigration favor for a friend around a person who had some legal issues. And if you read deep into the story, her answer was no. I mean, they decided no, they were not going to do that. Right.
But that kind of thing
happens
all
the
time.
People in the course
contact
of
people they know and ask for favors, and you politely, especially
say
in the State
no.
Department.
Especially if you're on a newspaper, Mike.
She said no. They were asked. She said no. And, the three of them that they offered, which was it's usually the three they would think are the most egregious, were really not egregious at all. She made an appointment to meet with the wife of one of her friends, Steve Ratner. What is egregious about meeting with her friend's wife? And in the third one, they were asked to set up a meeting from official from Bahrain, and Abedin's response was, we've already gotten that invitation through the regular channels. So the invitation had already worked its way through from the State Department channels. But the
Secretary of State would ordinarily take a meeting
right.
with the, a official from
right.
Bahrain.
And so,
US ally.
And mm-hmm. Secretary Clinton has said, I would have done it differently. And I think that we've learned what we need to learn from this issue. But again, it goes to a broader issue of the question is conflict of interest. And so then I go back to Donald Trump. Have we really thought through the issues of his potential conflicts of interest around his business holdings, both domestically and globally? Has there really been a close enough look at those, and what are the implications if he gets elected president, given his business holdings and given his debt?
We have a lot of letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll come back to a couple of the topics that we have left this morning. And where do we begin?
Okay, let's go to Doug, who says, just came in, thank you for the tribute to Toots yesterday, the harmonica player.
Great harmonica player.
Not only are you all brilliant and talented today, and every day's wonderful bumper music makes the panel and your engineer very hip. And
you're very hip, Rob.
Doug in Woodstock. And Matt says, why did no one advise Hillary and her staff not to use email so much? Pick up the phone. Not everything needs to be written down. Judy says, emails and taxes. If a judge can order the speeding up of Hillary's emails, why can't someone order the IRS to speed up Trump's audits so we can see his returns? That you would have, you buy the premise, buy the gag. You have to believe the reason he's not doing it is because of this lame excuse about the audit. That's
not
what it's about.
Let's do what Kelly Conway said. She said he should be transparent. Before she started working for him, his own current campaign manager said transparency. We need transparency around his taxes.
And now has turned on that.
She said she didn't realize he was under audit.
Like Nixon was when he released his taxes.
Yes. Yeah.
Where was she? Panel, says Bonnie, perhaps the issue is why Hillary isn't where Barack was at this point goes back to our species history. Male and female may have been finding fault in each other longer than humanity has recognized racial differences. And then Cynthia says, Ms. Conway defended Todd Akin when he made the infamous remark about legitimate rape. She has no principles, so says the writer. John says, Clinton, she wants it so bad, almost desperate, she will say anything. Her language is often sophistical, disingenuous, calculating, and her tone is strident, almost shrieking at times. Yes, Alan, she indeed bears watching. What? Go, Teresa. Teresa's upset.
When people describe women like that and her is shrieking, the woman is brilliant and she is focused and she's brilliant.
Really impressive.
And she's deeply committed. Her whole life has been dedicated to issues, the things that I care about, children's issues, issues of equality, and understanding early childhood education are critical, and health care. She's dedicated her whole life to these issues.
Well, let me ask you this, Teresa. Can she coexist with Richard Banyan from Breitbart as the two campaign leaders? It just seems that she is in such contrast and trying to pull Trump one way, and he'll likely pull Trump the other way. I mean, can that last?
You mean Kellyanne Conway?
Kellyanne Conway and Richard
Breitbart.
Right,
it's interesting that they appointed him, he's, no public face for him. He's disappeared. I think what he brings is he holds the far right when she moves to pivot to the center. So her goal is to get him to pivot. And Banyan being there holds that very hard right just by being there. But also, he is brilliant at social media. Breitbart is a very powerful tool to reach people. And I think that's he understands, and what they will use him for is to hold the hard right and to try to organize people under the radar screen through social media, and that's the expertise that he brings to the table.
Brian writes us a letter and says, new panelists, please make sure to bring Teresa back. She has wonderful insight.
All right. Thank
you.
Nice
vote there.
Thank you very much.
And then Scott says, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, why would you ignore the ducks and check out the geese? Not all the ducks are bad, but looking at the geese is a waste of time and effort. That's from Scott, I suppose.
I like ducks and geese.
Okay, are the ducks the emails?
There was code in that.
Okay,
one.
All right.
Let's just say he wants to see Donald Trump's taxes, and let's.
Okay, we'll do that.
We've had several letters saying that the Los Angeles poll is always suspect. And it has been in.
Well, wasn't it a USC? Also, USC was part of it, which is a legitimate university.
Polling, yes.
Yeah. Okay, my view on polls, any poll before Labor Day is suspect. The campaign really begins from Labor Day on.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that. Peter says, there's some time before the election, but I'm convinced that the sense of who Trump is and what kind of candidate he is has been firmly established in the electorate's minds. He's gone to great lengths to make that happen. I don't think there's time to change that. Well, if he's this close in the election, and I think he is close, maybe there's a point there.
I think there are a lot of forces at play. I think the media would like a tighter election. You know, that's just a natural thing. I think that the Trump campaign is sitting on a lot of money, you know, $80 million in ad buys, and anything can happen. I think this could still become it's either going to be a blowout or a very, very close race.
Yep. Barbara says, the L.A. poll, the poll has been an outlier forever. Its methodology is not standard. Peter says, I don't know what Peter says, it's something. And John says, good grief. John says, could the roundtable please speak to some of the commentators in the press that the addition of Stephen Bannon and Roger Ailes in the Trump campaign is looking to create a new conservative media channel post-election if Trump loses, or maybe even if he wins, that they will all be involved in.
That is a popular conspiracy theory
around. Yeah, yes. It's getting a little bit of attention that was Trump's plan all along, or his backup plan should he lose. But and
Michael then, Moore kind of started this fire, I guess.
And it does have some. I mean, Roger Ailes now could turn on Fox, which put him out, and
they have $46 million by
right,
the way.
Right, with a good payoff. Mm-hmm. He's well funded for it, and Breitbart and Ailes and Trump could create a new channel for people.
Well, what's interesting to me in this conversation, most people say if Trump loses, and my thought is, even more so if Trump wins, this a new and more powerful network, communications network, will be invaluable to him. So either way, I think that this is part of the process that Breitbart's been doing for a while of laying this groundwork for communications tools for the right.
No, I think that's right. The BBC this morning on the way in had a incredibly interesting program devoted entirely to the premise that Trump would win and what would his administration look like and what kind of chaos would be caused
who would be his Homeland Security director and his Secretary of State, do you think, and Attorney General?
And just the issue of words matter and the ability. He has no experience governing, and that's, I think, that's gotten lost in all of the focus on his outrageous comments, is that it requires skill to govern. And he has shown no evidence that he has that skill and even the base knowledge of the public policy issues to govern.
As Jesse Ventura found out, when he tried to be governor. On the other hand, it is the crux of his campaign, is that I am not of that group. And I'm going to bring a businessman. I'm not arguing this. I'm just simply saying.
Right. And it's very appealing to people who are frustrated about the establishment.
Would you have an inexperienced, a person who has no business experience, run a major global company?
It's been done.
Right.
Panel. Kellyanne was a senior advisor to the senatorial candidate who said that women can't get pregnant from being raped, and followed that up by being an advisor for Ted Cruz's campaign. Which of these efforts suggests that she's capable of running, turning Donald Trump into a viable candidate? Well, no. I think you have to understand who these folks are. These are people who go to work for a candidate, and they try to turn, the proverbial sousy or whatever, and that's their job. So if they have to defend outrageous statements like this, they do that. And if they come into Trump, I thought I saw something the other day, but I'm probably wrong. Nobody else has seen it, which is Trump is up there, and I thought his hair was getting a little grayer. In other words, wasn't
could have
quite,
been the light.
Quite, yeah, it could have been the lighting.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it was right after she came on, and it looked a little bit more sedate, a little less.
Toning down the orange. Kellyanne Conway also, she's not a campaign manager, she's a pollster. And her niche in polling has been among women. And trying to help candidates, not just women candidates, all candidates, raise their support, increase their support among women. And that's really her background. Hard right Republicans and as a pollster, not a campaign. This is her first endeavor, I think, as a campaign manager.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. Waterwheelvillage.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, for hardy mums, long-blooming perennials and shrubs, ornamental grasses, shade trees, and garden supplies. Wardsnursery.com. And the Enchanted City Troy, presenting a steampunk fair with Maker Flair this Saturday in the historic streets of downtown Troy. Open to the public, theenchantedcitytroy.com for information.
We're going to move on to some other topics, things making news. One of them, I found the story interesting, and maybe because it comes close to home, but I think it comes close to home for many of us, which is if you have an allergy, if you're allergic to bees or to peanuts or have a severe life-threatening allergy to something, often what is the antidote is the EpiPen. And you have it. You get two of them in a shot, meaning two of them for in a box, and they're good for a year. And you're supposed to keep them on your person at all time. And then when whatever disaster strikes, you stick it in, and it saves your life. Well, the last time I got one, I think it was with my current health care plan, it was $50. And you get two of them for $50. Well, now the device, which is trademarked and is produced by Mylan NV, is now selling for $600, and still only available as a set. Because they do say that you should have two on hand at all time. And this has become a big issue because more and more there is anxiety about the expense and the fact that, you know, I think I have one, I know my wife does. So you have one, Teresa?
I have a severe allergy to bees, and I carry my EpiPen with me everywhere I go.
So now you may not use it, but you may get stung twice in a summer. You don't know. And that's a lot of cash. So we've seen this in other medicines over the last year with a skyrocketing cost. So does any of this make sense to you as to why the costs have gone up?
Yes, well, greed.
Greed. I completely agree. It's unjustifiable. It's like that guy Martin Scorsese. He bought a pill that was selling for $13.50. He bought rights to it and raised the price to $750 per pill. And it's needed by people who had infections after being treated for cancer or for AIDS. It's just money.
So whatever happened to that thing with Scorsese? I know that people were really angry. And I think there were congressional investigations.
Right. Public pressure drove the price down.
Yeah.
Not back to $13.50.
No.
Now, and just yesterday, Pfizer bought a cancer treatment drug, you know, for billions of dollars. I mean, they're going to make billions and billions of dollars with it by charging a ton of money.
Now, the interesting thing here is, from my understanding, the reason that the cost went up is because they had competition, so that kept costs down. Their competition went away, and then they're like, "Oh, field day!" And then they went crazy with the price and steadily, and then went up markedly in the last year.
Greed. Alan said it. Greed.
Yeah. Greed.
And I know that Congress is looking into, you know, were there anti-competitive practices, but still, they're the only game in town so that they can. But this is not a new medicine. They can't say, well, it's because of, you know, we had to fund new research. It's just they're doing it because they can. But this, as you say, this is an issue, a larger issue about the cost of pharmaceuticals in this country. And also for some people who say, well, Republicans say, let the market work. Well, this is the market working, and it doesn't work well for people who need EpiPens.
And it gets people at the most vulnerable time, and it gets people who have no ability to pay this money. And if you have a child that needs an EpiPen, they have to give one to the mother-in-law where their child might spend the night. They have to give one to the teacher and the coach. And this is a lot of money that parents are going to have to shell out, and some won't be able to, and
that's
some
the
people,
point. Right. I think that's
some
exactly
people
the point.
It won't be protected.
You see a lot of people walking around with no front teeth, and that's because they can't
afford dentistry,
which is getting more and more specialized, and which is also a fortune to get your teeth fixed. And people just can't afford it, period.
And when I was working with Senator Kennedy on health care in the 90s, we 5 years of hearing after hearing and over again, we heard personal stories of people choosing between food and their children's medicine, making incredibly difficult choices. And the situation has only gotten worse. It's not gotten better.
Another just interesting side point to this article was that health facilities that have EpiPens on hand for in case a patient has an allergic reaction to a shot that they're given, that the cost for the medical for hospitals has gone up, skyrocketed as well. So
and for schools.
And for schools,
and
right.
Think about, for taxpayers, the cost to Medicare and Medicaid for paying for these drugs. But I think this is a case where we need a little public outrage, some, public conversation about this to see if what can be done about
it. So let me get this straight, Teresa. Will somebody's Medicare pay for the pen?
Medicaid would cover
Medicaid,
it if you were
yes.
eligible income-wise. Yeah.
Right.
And so taxpayers would pay. Yeah.
Right.
Mike, we have 3 minutes. Tell us about the river.
Oh, the Hudson River. Big news. The Hudson River PCBs, an issue that's been around for decades. Last year, General Electric completed a $6 billion cleanup of the Hudson River, through an agreement with New York State and the Environmental Protection Agency. And at the time of the closing of that project, a lot of environmental groups and many municipalities were saying, hey, there's still a lot of PCBs in that river, and we can't eat the fish. Commercial fishing of Hudson River bass has been suspended since the mid-70s. So the Cuomo administration was quiet a year ago when everybody else was clamoring to pressure GE to stay on it and continue to monitor it and maybe do some more dredging. GE says that they completed it as agreed to and they're done. Now the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation for the Cuomo administration, Basil Cegos, has come out in a press conference yesterday along the shores of the Hudson and said the EPA needs to hold GE accountable. It looks like the job wasn't finished. Why they took a year to say it, I don't really know. People were complaining that if they let GE off the hook, they'd dismantle all the dewatering and all the equipment up in Fort Edward. That's evidently happened, or at least mostly completed, and Cuomo's administration was quiet. The commissioner is calling that a red herring and that this is a long-term five-year evaluation and pressing the EPA right now to get back on it. So it's not over.
Some politicians put their fingers up into the air and see which way the wind is blowing, if you know
really?
What I mean.
Yeah. We're out of time. Teresa, thank you very much for being with us.
You're
great, Teresa.
Very, very nice maiden voyage. Mike, Alan, thank you very much. Okay. We'll have more roundtable after this.